This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Demonstrations of the anger in the African-American community over their treatment by law enforcement has come to Charlotte. In the wake of a Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officer fatally shooting Keith Lamont Scott on Tuesday, the city has experienced 2 days of protest, both of which began peacefully, but which became increasingly violent.
They got the police away to shut.
Last night, those protests spread to uptown Charlotte, and there was another shooting. This time, one civilian shot another. The victim remains on life support. Let's stress that most of the protesters were peaceful, but those that were not threw bottles of water, trash cans at police, and through the windows of businesses at the Epicenter and the Hyatt Hotel. The NASCAR Hall of Fame and an adjoining restaurant were damaged, and looters took merchandise from the Time Warner Cable Arena. City officials urged calm and promised a full investigation into the shooting that sparked these protests, but in the interim, Governor McCrory has declared a state of emergency and made Highway Patrol and National Guard troops available here to keep the peace. Mayor Jennifer Roberts took the lead yesterday during a press conference with Kerr Putney, the chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police, and Willie Ratchford, head of the city's Community Relations Committee. Mayor Roberts joins us now for the first part of the program in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning and welcome. Have you slept yet?
Good morning. I think about a couple hours.
State of emergency was declared at the request. A city has to request a state of emergency to be declared. So we asked that. I think the chief of police asked for that of the governor, and he said yes last night at about 11:15. What does that mean to the city of Charlotte, state of emergency?
A state of emergency gives us more tools as we continue to work with our community to keep the peace, to keep our citizens safe, to keep our property safe. And it gives us tools. It gives us access to the National Guard. It gives us the option of a curfew. That still needs to be discussed. There's a process in place with our first responders and our resources to talk about whether or not that's needed. So those are some of the things that we'll have as tools and to be discussed as the day continues.
So the National Guard is now available to you. Will they necessarily be deployed, or is that something that you'll call as the need arises?
Well, we're focusing on this evening, and we are about to have conversations with our police chief, our fire chief, our medic personnel, and the state personnel to talk about what that would look like, what that plan would look like, what would trigger that, how it would be deployed.
You had a news conference yesterday at about 9:30 with the chief of police and Willie Ratchford. There's going to be another one this morning at 10:30 with the three of you. Last night, however, as I was watching coverage on CNN and other locations, we didn't hear from the chief of police, and we didn't hear from you. I heard from you in the afternoon. Should you have been able to be, or would it have been valuable, do you think, for you to appear on television and on radio during the height of these protests?
Well, I had numerous interviews last night throughout the evening, mostly by radio or by voice on television. Mm-hmm. So I actually was very present in the media, working very hard to get the message out to the public and to reinforce the need for calm, to reinforce the fact that the family, the Scott family, has asked for peaceful protests.
Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, was commenting on this on Fox News last night. On this situation, and he was critical of you, and he was critical of Governor McCrory, because he said this would never have happened in his city because he wouldn't have permitted it, that you can peacefully protest, but when you throw a rock or a bottle at a police officer or you throw it through a window, that's it, you're done, you're out of here. And he said, I have 41,000 police officers at my disposal, and it would never have happened in my city. What would you say to that?
I would say that each city is unique and that each city has a different history, has different resources, has different approaches, and that one size does not fit all, and that it is pretty presumptuous of somebody from a different city with a different culture, background, and collaborative spirit to be making judgments. I would not make a judgment on another city like that. I think that you need to walk in someone's shoes. And look, our community has a tradition of collaboration. We work together. There were faith leaders last night in the middle of the crowd, linking arms, providing a buffer between the police and the protesters. That's the kind of community that Charlotte is. We're the kind of community that steps up and says, we are not this, that we have a long tradition of collaboration. Our community policing has actually been a model for other areas of the country.
If you watched this on television last night, what you're talking about was readily apparent. Right in front of the line of police officers near the transportation center, there were guys in white shirts keeping the crowd back, and they were not police officers. I guess they were the people you were talking about, the faith community.
There were faith community. There were people from our uptown area who were just concerned citizens. There were quite a few folks trying to say, we need to keep this peaceful, that violence is not the way forward. It's not who we are. It's not going to help advance our concerns.
Do you have crowd estimates on the size of the crowd last night at the height of the protests? Do you have any idea how many?
The estimates are, from what I've heard, 500 to 600 folks.
How many police officers were deployed last night?
Between 200 and 300. And again, some of that was fluid. It was fluid in terms of the number of people, because I'm not sure that all those 500 were in one place at the same time. There was a lot of movement. There was movement from Marshall Park to the uptown, to the transit center, in many different locations. And I think that, you know, those are probably the best estimates we have right now.
The police were very careful last night, I thought, just watching from the helicopter shots that I was seeing from the various television stations and the ground level shots that we were seeing when they were able to safely be on the grounds. The police did not really do very much, and there were broken windows and fires being set in the street and on the sidewalk, and we know of damage and some looting last night around the Epicenter area and the Time Warner Cable Arena. Why didn't they stop that? Why didn't the police move in to quell that kind of activity?
Well, there's a strategy for trying to keep the peace, trying to protect citizens as well as property in a way that is also safe for the officers. And that was part of the strategy used. I think that one of the reasons we're looking at additional resources is that might free up some of the police officers to actually make arrests. We do want to hold people accountable. People who are breaking the law need to be held accountable. And we know that there were acts of violence, that there were acts of destruction of property that will not go unnoticed, and that we will follow up on once we have more resources.
This is all happening because of the shooting of the African-American man by an African-American police officer in the university area on Tuesday. And you told CNN yesterday, as I watched you on CNN yesterday afternoon, that you want transparency. You told them that the police have been or will be showing you the video. Have you seen it yet?
I have not seen it yet.
Why not?
We have a process in place.
You're the mayor.
We are respecting the wishes of the family. Remember, this is a tragedy for the family, and the chief has elected to show them the video first and then begin to show myself and other community leaders.
Does that make sense?
The video.
We have riots in the streets. Does that make sense to A, not let you see the video before the family sees the video, and to not let us see the video? Because if the video demonstrates what the police say actually happened, which differs from a lot of people on the scene, if that video demonstrates the police are telling the truth, wouldn't that stop all of this?
Well, that's something we don't know about when you say if, because we know there are different angles. We know that there can be grainy, some of these videos. We don't know about the distance involved. And so since I haven't seen it, I can't really make an opinion about that.
That's my point, Mayor. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you can't talk about it, and you can't stand behind the police chief necessarily.
Even after I have seen it, I can't talk about it, because we have an ongoing investigation. And our policy is, when you have an ongoing investigation, you don't release evidence in dribs and drabs. You want everything to have a complete picture before you release that to the public, so that we don't have an incomplete picture of what might be the truth.
Other cities where this violence has taken place in the wake of these shootings, and I think it was Tulsa, and I think this was yesterday on one of the cable news stations, that they were talking about the violence in Charlotte versus the violence in their city, and they say that they didn't have the same violence because they released the dash cam and body cam video to the media and to the public. What's wrong with that?
Every case is different. Since I'm talking about a hypothetical and something I haven't seen, I can't give you an answer as to why the process right now and the police the police chief's discretion as to how that will be released. I can't give you an answer to something I haven't seen. I'm hoping to be able to see that today. Again, because it's an active investigation.
You know what that sounds like? Hoping to be able to see the video today? You're the mayor. Do you know what that sounds like?
Remember, we have a council manager form of government. We have state personnel involved. We have a protocol for emergency response, and I'm also respecting that.
Okay, but you're the focal point. You're the key person here. You're the one that the cameras point at when the violence breaks out. Is that fair to you, as somebody who has to stand in front of these cameras nationally and talk about this, if you can't see the video?
Well, I tell you what, Mike, you don't always have things that you would like to have when you're dealing with a crisis. And again, until we have a complete picture, we're still interviewing witnesses to what happened.
Should we change the process?
Those are things that we'll be discussing. You know, this is a fluid situation. We have the community leaders involved who are also very interested in having suggestions about a better process going forward. Absolutely, we can discuss those. But I can tell you our chief is well respected. He's respected in the force. He's respected. I've heard from other mayors in other cities who have officers who worked for him, worked with him. And, you know, there's a lot of respect there. I have to take that into account as well.
So in the interim, what does transparency mean?
In the interim, transparency is continuing to present to the public facts as we know them, to give them an update on the current situation, on our approach to how we're going to continue to keep peace in our city, our request to keep that peace. And as soon as we have a complete picture of the investigation, to make that available.
This shooting is not an isolated incident around the country. It's not even isolated in Charlotte. Is there something systemically wrong with law enforcement and their relationship with the African-American community and vice versa?
Mike, we know we have a history. We know we have a history of racial divide, not just in Charlotte, in our country as a whole. We know that we have challenges. We know that people need to work together across differences better than we have done. And we are committed in this community to confronting that challenge. We are committed to acknowledging that it is not equal, that not every single neighborhood in our city has access to good education, to good job prospects with benefits. Not every racial group has the same access, has the same pay. Women still aren't paid equal to men. We know that there are still inequalities. I'm committed to working very hard to decrease those and to remove those disparities.
We have 30 seconds left. Do you know how many times Mr. Scott was shot by police?
I have not seen the full report yet.
Really?
I tell you, Mike, we are hearing different things from the community and from there. Again, we want to make sure this investigation has the highest integrity. I am not going to give out information until I am absolutely sure that it is the correct information. I've heard from people who were in the crowd and heard from people in the community very different views. I want to be sure when I say it.
You used the word agitator yesterday when it comes to these violent protesters. Are you saying that the violent protesters are from outside of our city and coming in to take advantage of a bad opportunity, or are you saying that some of them may be citizens here?
Well, when you have 500 folks together, it's very hard to determine which are which. But I do know that there was a call I saw on Facebook to people from the region and from other parts to come and support. So there could be both.
Mayor Jennifer Roberts, I know you have to go to a meeting with the police chief now, so I thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Let's all work for peace.
We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and O2EMC, an independent power producer that develops, owns, and operates solar farms across the Southeast. Details about O2EMC solar development and its local impact can be found at O2EMC.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds hosting a trunk show featuring two collections from Alex Sepkus and Seti Couture today through Saturday in their location at Morrowcroft Village, South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. Tomorrow on the Local News Roundup, we'll talk more about the protests that turned violent in the aftermath of the fatal shooting of that African-American man by police in the university area, and we'll update you on what, if anything, has happened over the next 24 hours. Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf is skewered on Capitol Hill by the Senate Banking Committee over the bank's sales practices, and the City Council rejects suggestions they repeal their bathroom ordinance in exchange for an HB2 repeal. Those stories and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, protests erupted this week after the fatal shooting of an African-American man by police in Charlotte. This after another police shooting in Oklahoma. More than 2 years after Ferguson, debate over how police departments are addressing deadly force.
The conversation continues on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The shooting on Tuesday has allowed tensions between the African-American community and law enforcement that had been simmering to boil over. While officials call for calm and dialogue, others believe systemic change is what is needed, not just more talk. This, however, is a talk show, so let's engage in the latter and explore some of the things that have been released into the zeitgeist as the result of this incident. Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn are here. They're both reporters for WFAE News who have been covering this protest since it began on Tuesday afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Gwendolyn, let me begin with you. What do we know this morning? Because you were at part of this whole thing yesterday, last night, and the night before last, and the shooting on Tuesday. What do we know this morning that we didn't know yesterday?
Well, some of the things that came out from the press conference yesterday involved the police in terms of how many officers were there, who had a body camera on, and that the officer who did the shooting was in plain clothes, and that he did not have a body camera on, and that three officers did. So we learned things like that in terms of what happened from the scene, but there's still a lot that we don't know, and there's still the conflict between what's being said by the family and what's being said by the police.
And I'm just take me through the escalation of this, because it started both nights. It started at very peacefully and escalated into violent activity. And there was a report on WFAE yesterday, I think it was by Nick De La Canal, that mentioned one officer talking with a protester on Tuesday night and asked if he could ride along with police to see the situation from their point of view. And the officer said, I think I can make that happen. Did it happen? Do we know?
That I don't know if that was a follow-up on that, but that was a poignant moment to see that happen after all of the tear gas and the chaotic scene that happened. So whether or not that actually did happen, I'm not sure.
Tom Bullock, you were in the thick of it again last night in Uptown Charlotte. How many of the protesters, I know this is an unfair question to ask, but most of them were peaceful. What do you think the ratio was of peaceful to more violent protesters on the streets?
It's an important point to make, Mike. I'm glad you asked the question. The majority, the clear majority of people that were on the street around the Omni Hotel and the Epicenter were peaceful protesters. There was a much smaller group that were violent protesters or trying to, in essence, riot. And I don't use that word lightly, but this was not a riot overall. The vast majority of people were just there to protest. In fact, one thing that I saw that I think illustrates this is there was one white male who had a Roman candle, a form of firework, and he lit it. And he pointed it at the line of riot police. And before the Roman candle had time to go off, he was basically tackled by a group of African-American men. And they stamped out the Roman candle and pushed that guy as far away from the police as they could. And they were trying to calm the situation down. Now, obviously, there were skirmishes between these two sides, but the vast majority were peaceful.
And last night, as I told the mayor, as I was watching this unfold on television, you could see African-American men in white shirts mm-hmm. and ties between the line of police and the protesters, and they seemed to be, because you couldn't hear the audio, but they seemed to be pushing protesters back and trying to calm them down.
That's right, but that broke down pretty quickly because, in essence, what happened after the shooting, which again, city officials say was a civilian shooting another civilian. They say that no officer was involved in that shooting. Mm-hmm. the line of riot police moved down the street. And to clear their way, because the rioters, or the protesters, forgive me, were right there, they threw flashbang grenades, which were basically like giant fireworks, big firecrackers, and unleashed this huge bang. And then they tossed canisters of tear gas. So those people in the white shirts that were separating them, the protesters and the police, they, like everybody else, ran down the street until the tear gas cleared. And what was interesting to me here is that the protesters would regroup and then move right back up to the police. And at times, Mike, I was standing basically looking right down the middle, and these protesters were just inches away from the riot shields and the face guards of the police, and they were just sitting there yelling at it. It was a very tense moment.
You spoke during that situation last night to 31-year-old Eddie Thomas, who described what he saw at the protests.
It was all cool. The bike cops was cool with it until riot cops came out. And once the riot cops came out, within 5 minutes, you had a young man on the ground bleeding.
Was he alleging there that the police, because we added riot police to the mix of bike police, that escalated the situation? Is that what he's saying?
I think what he's getting at is that when the riot police came, tensions increased. And when you had protesters there, some who were clearly looking to be violent, and to be fair, I did see bottles of water, trash cans, plants that people had pulled from the ground all being lobbed at the police. When you see a riot police officer and you're looking for that kind of a confrontation, it does ratchet up the situation. And, you know, Eddie Thomas is a very interesting person. He is actually a public defender here in Charlotte. He says that he came to the protest around 7 o'clock to try, as you were explaining before, to try to keep the peace, and that just fell apart very quickly.
That was the same thing. What Tom is saying is what people said from the first night, that when the police officers put on the mask, that they felt that's when things got more tense, because people were very emotional, and they say when that happened, that it kind of kicked things up to a different level.
The city went through a lot of misery during the Randall Carrick trial, and that ended, of course, in a mistrial, a trial of an officer, a white police officer who shot an unarmed African-American, also in Northeast Charlotte area, and it ended in a mistrial. We did not experience this kind of protest in the aftermath of that.
No, Mike.
We didn't, and I was there when that verdict came, when that decision rather came down, and the police officers were lined up. They were mainly on bikes. Of course, the crowds were not as large as this, but they immediately began lying down in the streets, and police stood by and watched them. So the crowds were not this big, but I would say that the tension was very high among those who were out there. And one thing that, too, that because that particular trial ended in a hung jury, that I'm hearing from a lot of people that has intensified this particular case, because people were saying there was no justice in that case. That's what they're feeling. There was no justice. So now they're feeling like this one will probably end the same
way. And, of course, it comes on the heels of the shooting of the man, the African-American man in Tulsa over the weekend. WFAE's Michael Tomczyk was also out on the street last night. And he had a chance to talk to some protesters who bring in an interesting point of view. Let's hear from Bria O'Neill.
We're just kind of here to give a voice. A lot of people around the country don't really understand what's going on, and we need everyone to open their eyes and see this is happening. It's here. You can't ignore it anymore.
And he also spoke to Kiana Ralph.
I feel like to see it happen directly in Charlotte, you know, it hit home that we are in the area where we can stand for this. We don't have to see it on TV or hear people talk about it, but we can be a part of this now, so it's time to do something.
So we have people who want to be, they want their voices heard. Is that what most of this is all about, that the time has come for change?
That's what I was hearing from people, and some were even in tears when they said that they felt as if nobody was listening, and that they felt that it is time for a change. They felt like there was not justice. And the people I talked to were very emotional. Now, I was talking to a couple of young people who had been downtown last night. I was in a restaurant, and they were saying, too, they want peace. They want to be heard. They want to have a dialogue, that they were not in favor of the people who were throwing things and kicking in doors and that kind of thing, that they want to see things done in a different way.
So we've had two nights of something that's very uncharacteristic for Charlotte, and that is violent protests where property has been destroyed and lives were put at risk. And in fact, one citizen protester last night was shot by another civilian, and he remains on life support. Compare these two nights, because you were there both nights, Tom. Compare the last night to the night before.
Actually, I'll ask Gwendolyn to join in. I was not there the first night. I was there last night.
Well, neither of you were there then on both nights. So compare, if you can, compare. Compare notes here.
Well, why don't we start with Gwendolyn then? Tell us what you saw the first night.
Well, the first night was a lot of people, of course, were still coming in after midnight to take part in the protest, and they said they were all ages. They were not all African American. It was diverse in terms of race and in terms of age. And when they came in, they say they came to be supportive of the family, because at that point, which is like it is now, they only were hearing what the family had to say. So once everything started, the tear gas and everything like that, I was hearing people saying that they were saddened that it resulted in that because they wanted things to be peaceful.
Mm. Tom?
And it started peacefully last night. It started peacefully, you know, with a demonstration at Marshall Park, some pastors having people come into a sanctuary. It stayed peaceful till around 8 or 8:30, and then at the Omnia Hotel, when the crowd arrived there, that's when the mood definitely turned. That's where the shooting took place. And you know what was interesting is, again, the police have said that no police officer was involved in last night's shooting; that it was a civilian who shot a civilian. The crowd didn't care. That didn't matter to them. They were positive that this was because of the police. Whether they pulled the trigger or not, they were still responsible. And as soon as word of that happened, and as soon as the flashbangs started to fly and the tear gas really started to roll, that the mood changed dramatically. And, you know, confrontations, it was just this ebb and flow between protesters running back from the tear gas, then running back up to the line of riot police officers, then running back when the next round of tear gas came in. And at one time, Mike, at the transit center, they actually took the metal barricades, the temporary metal barricades that are set up there, and they brought them across the street to try to create their own barricade against the police. That didn't last for very long, but you know, they were tense is really the right word there. They were angry, and they were angry because they heard very quickly about another shooting that happened, and they just assumed that it was the police, and this was their moment.
Watching this unfold, I got the impression that the police were taking a very measured, careful approach to this last night. And, of course, the chief of police and Willie Ratchford with the Community Relations Committee and the mayor have all called for calm in the face of this. And yesterday, WFAE's Mark Rumsey also spoke to Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles, who also said she hopes that we can get back to peaceful protests.
One of the things that I think we've got to do is just let people understand that there are instances where people are feeling so much pain and hurt that they've got to have an opportunity to express it. But you can do that by being respectful and having those boundaries set.
That's what the crux of all this, I think, is. It's pain and anger and frustration about something that most people don't know about, but that people in the African-American community certainly know about. Patricia Albritton is chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee. She is in our Spirit Square studio along with Patrick Graham, president and CEO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. Good morning and welcome to the both of you.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Yesterday, we'll talk about first, talk about the pain and the frustration. I have African-American friends. I hear about this. I had a friend who had a traffic accident. He wrecked his car and was really roughly treated by law enforcement for no reason. Talk to me about that.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you're starting with that point because it is because of pain. There have been a number of situations around the country, and this is just the latest situation in Charlotte. And I think people want others to realize we are hurting. In the African-American community, we are scared. We don't know what's going to happen next. We have people who are afraid to even drive to work, to drive to church, to go to the supermarket because they don't want to have an encounter, a tragic encounter with the police. And we're not saying that all of those encounters will be tragic, but that fear is there in the community.
I think, too, that we've had such a history in the African-American community of being really these sort of gate crashes for democracy. We've used our pain to open doors for others, and it becomes very frustrating when you look now in an environment that you feel targeted and that you don't see the systemic change that you want. Because a lot of the protesters that we see now are not just responding to what I would call the ambulance, but they're really talking about the disease of injustice, a lack of fairness in our social justice system. And so all of that creates a pain that we can no longer hide. Yeah.
The fear that you talk about, I have heard people talk about this in the past, how they're afraid to walk through a department store because they're going to be tailed by somebody who, because they're black, they think they're going to shoplift. That's insulting, and it is frightening, and you could do something completely innocent and be hauled off by store security. They're afraid of driving down the street because if they get pulled over, they might get shot and killed. Now, maybe that fear is irrational, but it certainly, if you look at events around the country, maybe it's not irrational. On the other side of the coin, you have police officers who are quite obviously overreacting because of fear, don't you think? How do we break that barrier?
Well, one is that we have to definitely redefine, and that's going to be up to not just African-Americans, but this society in general. We got to redefine who we believe African-American, particularly African-American males, are. I mean, I think about so many of the labels that are tossed at African-American males, everything from the notions of them being criminals, being fathers or not being fathers. All of these things compound to give us a definition. And, you know, if we have time, many of them are not statistically even factual or true. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about this image, we actually use imagery, and this is something that I've studied at the University of Wisconsin. We use imagery oftentimes to develop policy, not always facts.
Give me an example.
So I'll give you an example. The CDC recent study 2013 on youth revealed that African Americans are least likely to have drugs on their person or even use drugs. Yet they account, right, for a large disproportionate amount of young people arrested, right, for drug crimes. And so oftentimes we will then base our policies or even our procedures on that fact that we believe that there's going to be more drugs in those communities, when the reality is that most of those are open market sales, and the majority of other people are having drugs and other things on their person in their private dwellings. So even the notion of home ownership, other things play a role in that as opposed to race itself.
And in fact, and we've had conversations about this on this program as well, the vast majority of people who are incarcerated in this country are African-American males, and there is a different way they are treated within the criminal justice system, not just by law enforcement, but by the courts system. That's part of what's simmering under the surface here, isn't it?
There's a lot that's simmering under the surface. It's the justice system. It's having equal opportunity for all of our citizens. One of the disappointments to me.
Let me stop you, and we'll come back and talk about that right after the break, because I don't want to interrupt you in the middle of a thought, which I've just done. But we'll come back anyway. Patricia Albritton, chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee, Patrick Graham with the Urban League, and Gwendolyn Glenn from WFA News. I have to let go right now. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, a community bank with strong Southern roots since 1934, focusing on commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Information available at southstatebank.com. And Carolina's Healthcare System's Levine Children's Hospital, delivering comprehensive pediatric care in a kid-friendly environment, giving you the care you demand when it's your child. Protests erupted this week, as we all know, after the fatal shooting of an African-American man by police in Charlotte. And the discussion about this will continue in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, because they'll also be bringing in the shooting in Oklahoma last week. More than 2 years after Ferguson, debate over how police departments are addressing deadly force, the topic of the conversation. So stick around for that, the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock.
The major party presidential candidates soon debate the issues, though they've already said a lot.
There's no such thing as free
Everyone
education.
Who goes to a public college or university should be able to do that without having to
taxes too high, wages too high.
I want to raise the national minimum wage to 12, which is
we're asking what's the issue and focusing on domestic terrorism this week on Morning Edition.
That's Morning Edition. I'm Marshall Terry. Join me weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Patricia Albritton, chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee, and Patrick Graham, president and CEO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, about the simmering frustration, anger, and resentment that has been bubbling under for years in the African-American community, which is obviously boiling over now in the aftermath of a shooting on Tuesday by Charlotte-Mecklenburg police of an African-American male in the university area. You were saying that what I'm talking about in terms of frustration, Patricia, is just the tip of the iceberg.
It is the tip of the iceberg. And the frustration is that it is stated that there is equal opportunity, but there is not. There's not equal opportunity for jobs and for education and even for upward mobility. And what I was saying is one of my disappointments in seeing the images broadcast across the nation last night is that people see a small group of people and believe that this is how it is in the communities in Charlotte. That's not how the majority of people work, live in Charlotte. And we have to be mindful that there have been successes made, but there are still a lot of opportunities and there are a lot of challenges that we have to face.
We live in a city where it is known nationally now that if you are born poor, your chance of climbing up the economic ladder is practically nil. And that is particularly impactful in the African American and Hispanic communities. Is that part of this?
I mean, for sure. In 2011, we released the study, The State of Ethnic Charlotte. And it actually predicted that you were heading to a point where you would be lowest in economic mobility. And it did it in a really literal sense. And what we found in that study was that people often connected to their realities in ways that we had not thought of. When they saw themselves unemployed, it affected their ability to believe that they could actually achieve anything. It actually diminished hope. And what's sad is that it was based on actual facts and not just an image or thought in their mind, that there were literally things that they could point to. For example, the Economic Policy Institute just came out with a study that African Americans have now the greatest disparity in wage earnings for the same jobs as whites as it's had since 1979. Think about that. That today the wage gap between ethnic groups is wider than it was in 1979.
Why?
Various reasons. One is obviously we still have systematic racism within our systems. We have to acknowledge that because we're talking about many times people who have the same skill sets, yet for some reason they don't earn the same. Two is, again, image. So when we talk about unemployment in the African-American community, which is normally double that of the majority population, what we've also found, particularly in the State of Ethnic Charlotte study, was that they still participated in the labor force at the same rate. So what that demonstrates is we're not talking about people who don't want to work. We're talking about people who sometimes, for various reasons, whether it's education, whether it's racism, are forbidden, are not allowed to work in the ways that they want. All of that lends to a great frustration that is not based on some magic notion. This is actually real.
In response to the shooting here and the one in Tulsa, Donald Trump, who has made a plea to African Americans to support him by saying, "What have you got to lose?" has said that the African-American community is in its worst shape ever, ever, ever. He did that. He did the three evers. Sure. Is he right?
No. There have been a number of accomplishments, movements ahead for the African-American community. No, we are not where we need to be, and I don't want to speak directly regarding Mr. Trump. No, I'm not afraid in my community to walk down the street. No, yes, I do have equal opportunity for education in most cases. No, we are not going back to the way things he believes it should be. There have been accomplishments, but there is a lot more to do. You can't attack the situation by saying, what do you have to lose, when you're not really offering any suggestions on how we can continue to move things forward.
Hmm. I don't know how long the Community Relations Committee has been in existence. It's been a long time. I can't remember a time when it wasn't in existence, and I've been here since 1985. So do you think you have been effective?
The Community Relations Committee has been effective. We have a lot of work to do. And it was actually started in 1961 by Mayor Stan Brookshire. Okay. So for over 50 years, we've worked on human relations in the city of Charlotte. The opportunities change through dialogues and through working with our community partners. We have made changes. We've seen changes in our business partnerships. There are hundreds of organizations throughout Charlotte who are working to bring people together in Charlotte. Yes, it has changed, but there's still more change that needs to occur.
At a press conference yesterday, some of the protesters got together and called for, one of them specifically, and I can't remember his name at the moment, called for an economic boycott of Charlotte. If black lives don't matter, he said, then let's take our dollars and keep them to ourselves. So boycott North Lake Mall, boycott South Park, boycott Epicenter, etc. Is that a good idea? That's what the NBA is doing. That's what you pointed this out. The NCAA, the ACC, the NBA are doing that with regard to HB2.
Well, you know, that's definitely one of those political hotbed issues. But here's the deal. When people are oppressed, we don't always get the opportunity, and we should not get the opportunity to always tell them how they should react to their own oppression. And I think that we've been used to doing that. So here is a case where someone has proposed an economic boycott until they see things change in the ways they want. I think that that's their right. And I'd actually rather see that, obviously, than opportunists sort of breaking into property in Uptown Charlotte. One of the things that I do know is that when you start to talk about economics, and it's been in our past ever, you know, you can even look back to the Montgomery bus boycott. Oftentimes, economics does sort of raise people's eyebrows and makes them think a little harder.
It's all about the money.
It is all about the money. And African Americans are, you know, both positively and negatively, great consumers. Mm-hmm. And they have an economic impact. And so if something like that occurs, maybe it's something that will draw more people to listen.
How would you characterize how officials have been handling this situation the last several days?
One thing I can say about the city of Charlotte, as you said earlier, we have been called together by the mayor, by Chief Putney, who is well respected in the community and throughout the nation, as Mayor Roberts said. They really try to bring in community leaders and organizations to develop solutions. In Charlotte, you don't see the mayor or even the city manager sitting up there and dictating, this is what is going to happen. They realize that we are a city working together, and we will continue to work together.
Well, we have a weak mayor system, and that was quite apparent in my conversation earlier this hour with Mayor Roberts, who has not been permitted to see the video that was taken by police of this initial shooting. I find that shocking, actually. I rarely should say things like that, but I think it's shocking that the titular leader of the city has not seen this video and yet is calling for transparency, as is the chief of police and everybody else involved in this. To you, what does transparency mean?
Well, I think in this case, transparency means that you definitely, in my opinion, you have to release the video. You have to discuss this openly. This is a time in our lives where we don't really have too many other options. I look at Tulsa, and you look at the reaction there, mm-hmm. after the release of video, mm-hmm. after discussion, they're not doing the same things that we're doing.
That's
here.
Right.
It's
and
not
in,
happening.
And in 8 days, the law gets stronger.
In
on October
days,
the
right.
1st, it becomes against the law to release the video.
I'm on a development committee with the police department. I understand that law, and I understand what it means when it comes. And I will tell you this. I think that a lot of our elected officials, as well as some of our leaders in this community, we were actually thrown back. We were in shock for a minute because you've got to think, we've always hung our hat with pride
yes.
that Charlotte has never reacted this way. So I want the public to also understand that these are human beings and they will have to make adjustments. There will be some mistakes as well. So part of this is us working together, being patient, and trying to really think about the long-term ball.
We have never reacted this way. Why are we reacting this way now? What forces are at work that make this situation different?
I think it's an accumulation of things that have happened across the country. A number of comments that I have heard is, when did the Tulsa shooting happen and when did the Charlotte shooting happen? Because people are putting the two together. They're happening so frequently, unfortunately, that you almost can't separate what's happening where. You wake up in the morning and you wonder, okay, what has happened in what city? Who has been shot?
And the force of social media is something that I don't think power structures understand quite yet, even though they've seen demonstrations of the power of social media at every level in every country across the globe. I don't know that you can withhold camera video from dash cams in an era of social media.
It is like the Wild West.
It's like putting the genie back in the bottle.
That's right. It's like the Wild West. We're in technological expansion in ways that we can't understand because it happens so quickly, and social media is obviously one of those. But here's something else I just want to say. Charlotte, as a community, we have to be courageous and brave enough to own our own history. You know, you had the Kirk trial. You had other incidents before this that have built up in Charlotte. And we have always tried to deal with them civilly, even those who are on the side of change. And the reality is that we no longer can just say it's something that's just in the air in the nation and that actually feeds into Charlotte, but that Charlotte has its own fever, its own symptoms that we have to deal with. And I think that as soon as we come to that conclusion and really embrace that, it'll make it easier to work towards change.
In the civil rights era, we had African-American and white leaders coming together to try to break that barrier, taking African-Americans to lunch in segregated lunchrooms where they were not allowed to be, and essentially the white leaders saying, kick us out. Go ahead, try. What seems to be missing from this situation are leaders on both sides. Where's the Robert Kennedy coming into a situation among African Americans the night that Martin Luther King was shot and killed to defuse that? Where are leaders coming in to defuse this? Where are these people?
I think what is missing is that you do not see the work of many individuals who are doing exactly what you said. In that time, it was very easy for one person to stand up and say, this is what we need to do, or to lead the effort. We have so many challenges and opportunities, and there are so many people working a number of issues. It's hard to pinpoint one person, but just keep in mind that things are moving and people are doing exactly as you said.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say something that my sister really leads towards, though. It's not what's missing, it's what's been the addition. We have become so much more diverse, and our notions of leadership have become much more diverse. You have many people representing many constituents throughout this community, both elected and non-elected. And so what that means is no longer are the days we can take a paternalistic view where you have a few people who make decisions. That day is gone. It's not going to come back. And you can see evidence of that actually last night. It's just like when we released the state of ethnic Charlotte, there was certain groups of people who looked at the policies and said this would be good. There are others who just ignored them, right? And that's because we are all sort of, in a way, jockeying for ways to get voice in a new, very diverse, very spread wilderness, even within the African-American community. Very diverse group now, diverse notions of leadership, diverse notions of what should be done. And so this becomes more difficult. Our greatest strength in Charlotte is our growing diversity. Our greatest challenge in Charlotte, our growing diversity.
Chief Putney and his predecessor, Rodney Monroe, and organizations like Cops and Barbers and others have been working to build better relationships between the African-American people and the police department. How's that working out? Is it helping?
It is definitely helping. And again, that is just a point that emphasizes that there are a number of different factions and different groups in the community that are working to improve and bring the community together. And what I want is that to continue to grow. Charlotte is a population of over 1 million people. I don't want the events of the last two nights to taint what we have done, and what we will continue to do. There's an opportunity for us all to live and work together.
Do either of you know John Burnett? Or John Barnett, excuse me. John Barnett is a Charlotte-based civil rights activist who helped organize last night's rally at Marshall Park to mobilize what he said is getting rid of dirty cops inside the police force. He said it's all about fighting the system and getting rid of these dirty cops who's inside. You got a virus, you need some chemotherapy to get that virus out. Do we have dirty cops? Bad
if
cops?
If you've listened to Chief Putney before, and he has said numerous times, and this is from the chief himself, yes, there are dirty cops. But they don't have, there's not a system in place that you can just go out and say, I'm firing this cop because what I believe he's not doing, he or she is not doing correctly. There is a process to follow. It is not a perfect police force. It is one of the best in the country. And they will work through what they need to do to weed out these people who do not believe should be on the police force.
People want justice. The Panthers' Cam Newton could not avoid this yesterday in a press conference. Neither could Ron Rivera. But yesterday, Cam Newton said that he's a firm believer of justice. I'm a firm believer, he said, of doing the right thing, and I can't repeat it enough, of just holding people accountable. Are police being held accountable in 30 seconds or less?
No, I think that in some cases they are, and obviously in some cases they're not. But here's the real issue. We have to have systemic change within social justice systems, period. Prosecutions, other things that have led to this, because police actually are just the fingertips. They're really not the head.
Patrick Graham, President and CEO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, Patricia Albritton, Chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee. Thank you for